The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Today
FM. In 20th century Ireland, the Kennedys were heroes. Didn't they do well, those emigrants, going on to have the first Irish Catholic president of the United States and his celebrity in Ireland copper-fastened by a visit not long before he was assassinated in 1963. The Kennedys continue to hold a fascination for many Irish people, but I wonder how they will take the new book by Maureen Callaghan, which is damning in the way that the Kennedy men have treated women over the decades. It's called Ask Not, The Kennedys and the Women They Destroyed. Maureen Callaghan, explain how they destroyed women, please.
Oh, Matt, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Second, it's hard to know where to begin. We are talking about women who have either been lobotomized, raped, sexually assaulted by a sitting president in the White House, left for dead in a shallow body of water, driven to suicide, gaslit to the point where they can't tell what's up from down. If you fight back, these women have had their reputations just slaughtered in the mainstream media in America. As one distraught wife who eventually committed suicide, the second wife of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., currently a third party candidate for president of the United States, said, they could destroy me. And they did.
Let's stick with him, given that, okay, maybe he's an also-ran in the presidential election race, but he is there and he has his supporters. But tell us about the sex diary that he wrote and how that then led to the suicide of his second wife.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. Here in the States, Bobby Jr. has been taken to task for many controversial things, but his treatment of women is not one of them. And that's a big reason this book exists. Obviously not the sole reason. We're talking about generational examples of this, but Bobby was married to a beautiful young woman named Mary Richardson, who was devoted to him. They shared four children together. One day she discovered what Bobby called his sex diaries, or maybe the press did. Regardless, they were these ledgers that listed by name the multiple other women he had been with. Many, many women, sometimes two or three in a day, sometimes at the same time. Some of these women are very famous. Some of these women were friends of Mary's. They were ranked 1 to 10, not by performance, but by how far they had gone sexually. When Mary discovered these diaries, it destroyed her. But what Bobby did was, instead of helping his wife, he sort of doubled down. He wanted out of the marriage. They would at times go see Mary's therapist together. Her therapist is named Sheena Henkin. She spoke to me for the book. And she told me that Bobby said to her, in sum and substance, I want you to diagnose Mary as mentally ill. This is a tactic straight out of the Kennedy playbook. If a woman becomes inconvenient, call her crazy. And Sheena Henkin, to her great credit, said, Bobby, your wife is not mentally ill. She is sad and she is angry, but she is not mentally ill.
And how much later before she took her own life?
It wasn't much longer than that. It was maybe a year later, 2 years later. Bobby, by that point, had moved out of the house. He moved into another house close, like a stone's throw from Mary's, the house, the marital home they had shared. He had taken up with a famous American actress. They were busy flaunting their relationship all over the press, all over social media. Bobby was starving Mary out. He had been ordered by a court to provide her with a $20,000 a month stipend, which he was no longer paying. He cut off her credit cards. She was becoming increasingly at loose ends. She would show up to the school run in this very wealthy suburb of New York and have to beg the other mothers at the school run for $20 to buy groceries or to gas up her car. This is an extreme humiliation for someone who had been considered part of America's royal family.
Talk to me about his cousin, the late John F. Kennedy Jr., who died in what you describe as a murder-suicide at the turn of the 20th century into the 21st century.
Yeah, Matt, this is an interesting one. Here in the States, we just marked the 25th anniversary of that plane crash on Tuesday. And much of the media coverage here is always very gauzy and romantic, and it's about what we lost. And there's only one person we ever lost, and that's JFK Jr. In the book, which, you know, it's written like a novel, so you're in the heads and the hearts of these women as they're going through these most extraordinary life circumstances. He broke every single rule of aviation that night, every single one, aside from not being rated or capable of flying this incredibly powerful private plane. He didn't file a flight plan. He took off in terrible, abysmal weather conditions. He cut off his communications with ground control. He did not engage his autopilot. He almost, this goes unreported every time and has since the crash, he almost crashed in to a packed American Airlines commercial jet making its descent into New York City that night. If not for the quick thinking of those professional pilots, there would have been human carnage on a grand scale. Instead, they diverted. He went out over the dark black ocean at night with his wife and her sister on board. His life was coming apart at the time. His marriage was on the verge of utter collapse. They were not living together. He was not speaking to his sister, his once beloved only sibling. They were fighting over Jackie Kennedy's estate. His magazine, his first and only professional endeavor, had failed on an epic scale. He had just received a letter from his publisher indicting his stewardship of said magazine, the letter in essence calling him, quote, lazy and stupid. So I think when you look at everything in its totality, whether Junior was cognizant of his own wishes or not, it was a murder-suicide mission. And you'll see in the book, there's a long pattern of JFK Jr.'s death wish. He had come close to death many times, but what makes his unique is that he would bully every woman or many of the women he was with into these life-threatening circumstances. It wasn't enough that he would maybe die. They had to go with him.
I'm not going to go to Teddy Kennedy in Chappaquiddick or John F. Kennedy's behavior as a senator or indeed as a president, but I want to go back further to the patriarch, Joe Kennedy Sr., and his attitude towards women. What can you tell us?
So Joe Sr.'s attitude towards women, I believe, is exemplified in what he did to his beautiful, vibrant, vivacious daughter, Rosemary, who I believe suffered a fate worse than death. Had he murdered her, it would have been a kindness compared to what he did. Rosemary had some learning disabilities. Rosemary began exhibiting mood disorders in her late teens, early 20s. Without telling his wife or any of her siblings, he took Rosemary, when she was in her early 20s, to a hospital in Washington, D.C., and had her forcibly lobotomized. Rosemary was left with the physical and mental capacities of a two-year-old. She couldn't even take herself to the toilet. She couldn't speak. She couldn't do anything. The why of that, once it was discovered, and I mean, we're talking like 40 years later, the American press realized that this vanished daughter had been hidden away in a convent in Wisconsin. What was often theorized and sort of co-signed by the Kennedy machine was that Rosemary was so cognitively impaired and the family was so desperate for anything to help that they mistakenly overreached and the lobotomy was a failure and they never really emotionally recovered from it. That's not so. What I learned while reporting this book is that many close to the Kennedy family believed that Joe had been molesting Rosemary, that the mood disorders were actually a result of her trauma coming out and that Joe, who was busy raising future U.S. presidents, was desperate to keep this quiet. And the lobotomy was the means by which he made that happen.
I imagine that there are people who are saying that a lot of this is tabloid tittle-tattle and saying this is stuff that can't be denied by people who are dead. But on the other hand, why do you think it's important to put this family story all together in the way that you've packaged it?
Well, Matt, you're not wrong. There have been some, especially here in the States, the Kennedys still remain very much revered. But I think to minimize it as tabloid tittle-tattle, not that you're doing so, but those who have, that's a very common way to minimize these women's stories, these women's trauma. I wouldn't call the systematic rape and abuse and physical destruction of these women, reputational destruction, tabloid tittle-tattle. I wouldn't call parts of these stories that have been adjudicated in criminal courts in America tabloid tittle-tattle, or the enormity of these women's lives that have been documented over the years by eminent historians. And, you know, the other thing I'll say to that is here in the U.S., very recently, there were about three, like, door-stopping biographies of Ted Kennedy written by men. Hagiographic, you know, with, like, these ludicrous titles, like Catching the Wind and Against the Wind and What Happened with Mary Jo Kopechne at Chappaquiddick while his car left the bridge. It's all very passive. These stories matter. They're very consequential. And this book is not just sort of a rehashing. There's original stuff in here. There's new stuff in here. You're going to meet women you thought you maybe knew, but really never have met. And I consider it really both reconsidered American history and very much a reflection of women circa now.
Maureen Callaghan, thank you for joining us. It is a riveting read. It's Ask Not, the Kennedys and the Women They Destroyed.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.